Okay, so enough with the virtual reality jokes, I think. Okay, so previously we showed the example program where we had the texture map video running live on the cube. And so that demonstrates, you know, how we can capture video, throw it onto a polygon, make it all work and so forth. So what we'll do now is we'll quickly go through the source code for the display portion of the code that sort of does that part. Okay, so the actual lecture notes for the class contain, the lecture notes contain quite a bit of more detail about how it all works and so forth. So if you really want to find out more, you should really look there. Cool, okay. So this texture.cc file contains most of the bits that take the image, dump it on the display. Just trying to think if there's anything useful here to show people. Okay, I guess I won't talk about this in too much detail because the notes contain quite a bit more, and also this is one of those things that we either have to talk about in a lot of detail or not much detail, so we'll probably go for the not much detail option because we don't have too much time. But basically what happens is when you want to replace the texture with the incoming video from the camera, what you do is you tell PL, so you can see here, you enable the texturing mode, you activate the texture. What happens is in GL, when you want to do texture mapping, you create a texture and OpenGL gives you a handle number. That's like an ID number that you can then draw to later on. And what happens is we then activate that handle. We then call GL text subimage, which simply takes in the data for the texture map as a char buffer pointer and then just dumps it into the video card at some point later on. So it's pretty straightforward to load a texture into the video card and to draw a square using a texture, use this code here. So you enable the 2D texturing device, you bind the texture, which activates it once again. The way GL works is it tends to have a lot of state in it. So rather than having lots of handles and pointers, you have to activate handles to make them active. Then what happens is you do GL begin. GL begin and GL end are responsible for starting and ending a primitive. You then use GL vertex 2F commands, which specifies the corner points of the box, and GL text code 2F specifies which corners of the texture map you want to do. So by fiddling these values here, you can adjust the shape of the texture map and also how the texture maps to it as well. So you can have a trapezoid shape with the four corners of the video mapped to the trapezoid, and the GL card will stretch it automatically. So the cool part with the way GL works is you specify the four corners that you want to draw, and you specify the four corners to map those two into the texture map, and then OpenGL calculates the necessary transformation to make it happen for you. The actual mathematics behind it is quite complicated, but OpenGL takes care of all of that for you. This source code's all here so you can look through, so I won't go through in any more detail, and it's on the live CD and so forth. So we'll go back to the slides now. Okay, so the next thing we're going to talk about now is live video capture. So there are a number of ways of capturing live video under Linux. The previous example showed how to display video. Now we're going to show how to capture that video in and save it into a buffer in memory so that you can then play with it and do whatever you want. Capturing video is supported under Linux. We've had support for it for quite a long time. PCIe USB cameras were supported in 2.3 kernel in about 1999 or so forth, in 2000. So yeah, 2000 was when these things were supported. So it's been around for a while, and we've had PCI capture boards and so forth for quite a lot longer before that as well. So the USB and FireWire cameras are quite cool because they allow us to work with portable devices now, such as laptops. Whereas previously, you always had to have a PCI capture board or something else like that. And obviously you don't have a PCI bus when you're playing with a laptop without storage. So capturing under Linux works. The interfaces are non-trivial and a bit tricky to use. And what we really need is a nice userland API to simplify it. So I was actually talking with someone in the audience just before during the break, and they're working on a project called GStreamer, which is basically a unified API that takes the video for Linux, 1394 and so forth, and attempts to provide a framework similar to what DirectShow or so forth is like on the Windows. Having just the ability to suck video frames from a camera is useful, but the really hard part as such is transforming it, scaling the image, converting it to different resolutions, different color spaces, and these kind of functions are sort of difficult to do if you have to do it yourself. So things like GStream and DirectShow, what they do is they provide a framework where you say to the framework, I want a video frame that's in RGB with 24 bits and I want it this resolution. And the framework then negotiates with the camera and scales the image and transforms it if necessary. However, if the camera supports that mode natively, then it'll give you the images directly from the camera. So it's sort of like OpenGL in that it provides an abstraction. However, the problem with abstractions is that if the card doesn't support it and the conversion is expensive, then everything will slow down. So you've sort of got to make sure your hardware's adequate for it. So we'll talk a bit about video for Linux and 1394 today. We won't talk about GStreamer, but it's probably something you should have a look at. I haven't looked at it myself either, so it's probably something to keep in mind. So the problem with video for Linux and friends is that the developers have to supply a lot of their own code. So you end up reinventing the wheel 100 times over, which is quite painful. There's also not much documentation for video for Linux, and it's also not commonly used, so it's not maintained as well as the rest of the kernel is. So the other day I did an apt-get on some packages and it downloaded a new version of libc6-dev or something, and someone had changed all the header files to use different ifdefs, and they didn't test the video for Linux driver H file, so my stuff doesn't compile anymore, and I had to go and hack the header files by hand. So I've got to send some email to a few people to get it sorted out. So the video for Linux stuff is not as thrashed out as, say, the SCSI driver or opening a file or something like that. So it's basically, you know, what people use is the bits that are tested the most. So video for Linux isn't thrashed out as much as everything else. So V4L was the first common kernel API for doing video capture on the Linux. It was based on the BTTV capture driver for PCI cards a few years ago. They took the API and used it. Supports PCI boards, USB cameras, and so forth. There's a program called XAWTV, which you can use to display video. So that's a good V4L video capture program. And the way V4L works is basically has an open call where you open up dev/video0, and that's the video device. You can't cat it as such, but you can do ioctls to configure it to dump video. You have to send an ioctl to the camera to tell it to start streaming the video off it. And then you can use either read calls to read frames off the camera, or you can use mmap to map it into a space in memory, and it'll copy the frames from there, and you can then copy them out and use ioctls to control it. Now, one of the real killers about V4L that really annoys me, I think it could be just the CPIA driver, it could be all of them, I'm not sure, but it doesn't support non-blocking I.O. So there's no way you can say to the driver, start the capture, but I'll come back later on and grab the data. It's always start the capture and then it just blocks for 300 milliseconds and then it gets back to you. So if you want to write a proper V4L app that can do other work simultaneously, because the way my software is architected is it has a select statement that pulls multiple file descriptors. If you want to do that, you have to have a separate thread to handle just the video capturing and then synchronize the frames in otherwise. So it can be a bit painful for that. The 1394 one, I think, is a bit better in that regard. With video for Linux, you can specify the resolution and pixel format, but the device has to support it. If you pick a format that's not available, then it won't work. So it's very important that you pick a value that's appropriate, otherwise you'll have trouble. If not, then you have to supply your own conversion. V4L, I find, with the CPIA driver, is that occasionally it just locks up or it won't detect the camera or whatever. So what you do is you pull the camera out, stick it back in again. Sometimes that fixes it. If that doesn't fix it, then you reload all the drivers that it uses. There's a module called CPIA, there's one called CPIA_USB. Each camera has different drivers. One of the things about USB cameras to realize is that every single one of them is different. There is no standard USB camera interface. And so the person I was talking to before said that currently there are no USB 2 cameras supported under Linux at all. And of the USB cameras, they're all non-standardized. So every single camera needs a driver written particularly for that model. and that's why that USB camera support under Linux is quite poor. Later on though, I'll talk about FireWire cameras, and they're all standardized, so every FireWire camera will work without any driver support, so that's very nice. So the V4L stuff with the USB cameras, it's useful, but it's a bit of a hack, I guess. And you know, if you can get it to work, then that's good. There's a new V4L2 API, which is available in kernel 2.5 and 2.6. I guess the problem with using V4L2 right now is that not every driver has been updated to support the new API. So if the particular camera you have, like the CPI one I have, this hasn't been ported over to the new interface, you can't use it. You have to use the old V4L API. So I guess in the meantime, sticking with V4L2 is probably the safe bet until you get something with drivers for V4L2. So the cool part about the original one is that there's a backwards compatibility layer, so that if your application uses the first generation but the driver is second generation, it can port the calls to the old version as well. So V4L2 still doesn't provide a userland API. That's where things like GStreamer still come in to fix that up. So what we'll do now is we'll quickly go through some V4L2 code just to have a quick look at it. Once again, this example is on the CD-ROM so that you can look at it in your own time. It's relatively simple, but the API is quite weird and tricky to understand. Where's that wrong font size? Okay. Can everyone read this? So when you're opening up the video from Linux device, you simply do an open call on the device, so it's pretty straightforward. You just open it up, it's this file descriptor. You can capture the capabilities of the video camera, so if you do an ioctl on the file descriptor, there's a call called video cg cat, and it returns back a dev info struct, and it returns back things like the name of the camera, how many channels it has if it's a TV tuner, minimum and maximum resolution values, and you can see here my example prints all these values out, so you can go through this later on. What I then do is I configure the height to be equal to the maximum height available, so I tell the camera, set yourself to whatever the maximum image is capable of. Some error checking. Error checking is always good. More error checking, the better. We then set the channel equal to the first channel. You then set it with that ioctl call. So these ioctls have all got really obscure kinds of names. They're not really friendly to play with. So having another API on top is a lot easier. We then set things like the brightness and view. You have the ability to do color transformations while the camera's operating. In many cases, the cameras will automatically adjust themselves as they go, and you can turn these things on and off. There's also a cool API where if you plug in the camera for the USB ones, stick them in, and if you go to the proc file system, there is some stuff in there that you can play with as well. So if we go to CD video, so you can tell what type of camera it is. There's also another device somewhere here. CPIA, where it shows all the settings for the video camera. So you can see the VF Linux driver version. It's also got a whole pile of flags that you can set as well, that control how all the camera works. So it's brightness. Sorry? Proc CPIA / video 0. This is for the CPIA driver in particular. Each driver chooses to expose whatever it wants. There's no guarantee that anything will happen. It also transfer rate stats, and the cool part is you can actually reprogram the camera using shell script. So if there's a value here called brightness, which is currently set to 50, what you do is if you do echo brightness :100 greater than video 0, that actually reprograms the CPIA device so that it will operate using a different brightness value. So it has the ability to read arguments off of the file system as well. So these are kind of a few things you can do. The other thing you can do is also just run the XAWTV app, which also has the ability to control the camera. It always complains usually. There we go. Okay, so that's the image from the camera. This camera is blurred because I brought the wrong one in with me, which is broken. But you have settings where you control things like brightness. Oh, no, it's okay, I'll just go with this. Thank you. But yeah, so, I mean, X8WTV has a number of different controls that you can use to play with the camera. But with most of my stuff, what I do is I leave the camera in auto mode so it adjusts itself. Because when you're going outside to the inside under the street and stuff, the lighting conditions tend to change quite wildly. So it's a bit hard to program in advance for it. I'll just skip through most of this. This is, in this particular example, it's setting up mem mapping mode. And here later on you can see it's doing a mem map. So what it does is it allocates some RAM, and then all the video frames as they come in are copied into that. So I won't go into any more detail here. The actual part where you start the capturing mode is you have to call an iOctl. That tells the device to, yes, begin capturing now. So it starts the capturing process, fires everything off. There's another function here called CaptureV4L. What this does is it says, I would like to request a frame now, please. And it sits there and waits for the frame to come in. And then the getV4L function simply goes to the memory map and then just copies and returns back a pointer from the memory map. And then now you've got the video. So this here is a very simple set of functions that do the bare minimum you need in order to talk to a video camera. So you can have a play with that if you want. And that cube demo uses this code to be able to do what it does. Okay. The AR Toolkit also has a capture library built into it as well that can talk to video for Linux cameras, DV cameras, and DC cameras. And you can use the AR Toolkit as well to do talking to video cameras if you don't want to use your own code. You can use someone else's if you want. Okay, so what I'll do now, I'm going to talk about FireWire capturing. So this is the alternative from Video for Linux. Now, FireWire cameras are like the green one on the front of this helmet here. The thing with the FireWire cameras is that they don't have a Video for Linux interface. So if you've written an application that talks Video for Linux, it won't be able to talk to a FireWire camera, and vice versa. They're not compatible with each other. They're completely different. So you need something else on top of it, either your own interface or GStream or something like that, to provide an abstraction for you to use. Now, Linux has had FireWire support for about 2 years. It's worked well in the 2.4 kernels and so forth. Most of my devel boxes use like 2.4.20 or 2.4.22 or something like that. So as long as you've got the latest 2.4 kernel, you have pretty much everything. The very early 2.4 series kernels had problems with their FireWire code, so you should avoid using them and use the latest ones. Linux has had FireWire support for quite a while. And it supports hard drives, so you can get a removable hard drive, plug it in, and that works. I've played around with them quite a bit. And it also supports digital video cameras and digital cameras. Now, there's two differences. A DV camera is like a camcorder, like that one on the tripod over there. It's a video camera that you film people with. It records to DV tapes. And the protocol that actually writes to the tape is called digital video. So you can talk to a DV device using a library called libdv. And what that does is it talks to the camera. The camera dumps DV frames, and they're compressed in some YUV encoded style format with compression added to it. So the camera basically dumps it out, but the computer has to do a reasonable amount of work to crunch the video and rearrange it to make it presentable in RGB format. Now, the other standard that's available is a digital camera, a DC camera. So this green camera here is a DC camera. What that does, that doesn't do any compression. DV is more bandwidth friendly than DC is, but DC cameras are cool because they can provide you a raw RGB frame of an image just captured straight from the camera. So what it means is that your computer doesn't have to spend any time decompressing the image or converting it to a different format or whatever, because you can say to the camera, give me RGB 24, and it'll go okay, and it just dumps you 300 kilobyte frames off the camera, 640 by 480. RGB data, and you can dump it straight to your video card. So that means there's no conversions. The USB camera dumps it in a YUV format, and that format has to be converted in order to send it to a video card. So the CPU has to do that, which is more time wasted, and more time you can save, the better, because the CPU is quite precious when you're outside with a laptop. So we're not going to talk too much about DV cameras today. I haven't really used them all that much. But I'm going to talk mostly about DC cameras. And as I said before, the DC cameras are quite nice. They're supported using this libDC library that I showed how to install at the start of this tutorial. And they support YUV and RGB up to 640 by 480. If you're in the YUV mode, you can get 30 frames a second. And if you're in the RGB mode, you can get 15 frames per second. So because the YUV mode is slightly more bandwidth efficient, they can cram more pixels across the wire. So it's nice for PCs because there's no DIG compression required. So the libDC library is a bit of a beast, and there's almost no documentation for it that I've been able to see anyway. Basically, most of what you can glean from it tends to be from the header files. So you go to the header files, and it doesn't really have much useful at all. Just to give you an example, we'll bring it up. So, you know, I mean, one of the problems with a lot of authors' attitudes is that they're like, oh, I don't need to provide documentation because the header files document themselves, but sort of you read it and there's no comments anywhere in here, and it sort of has a few constants here like frame rates and stuff, but then, so that's pretty straightforward, but you get to the actual function calls, and it just has these structs. So a camera structure, you know, what's a CCR offset, you know, who knows. So there's no documentation that really describes in detail what these actual values do. So when I first got this libDC library, I mean here, it's got a whole dump of these structs. But how to actually configure this for a DMA transfer, I've got no idea. So when I first got the libDC code working and everything like that, I had to find an app that could actually talk to it. And AR Toolkit's any app I've found, apart from Coriander, that actually has the ability to talk to a FireWire camera. And finding examples and stuff is quite difficult. So the header files weren't too useful. And so finding documentation for this particular library is quite tricky. So what I did with my software was, rather than trying to write my own interface to it, I actually just used the AR Toolkit capture library to do it for me. The AR Toolkit people, when they wrote the capturing software, they wrote it in layers. They wrote a capturing library, a vision detection library, and a display library. The capture library has three plugin modules. It actually has five. It has a libDC one, a libDV one, a V4L one, it has Windows, and it also does SGI video as well. So you can plug in a different capture library depending on what system you're on and what kind of hardware you've got. And I just wrote a wrapper around the AR Toolkit function. So in the example code that I showed before, I've written a wrapper code that does 3094 camera reading, but it uses the AR Toolkit code to do all the work for us. I could never work out how to set up the DMA transfers and all that kind of stuff to make it work properly. And I had a friend of mine in Japan who wrote the AR Toolkit code, so I just took that code and made it work, so that saved myself a lot of time. The cool part about the DC camera specification is that there's actually a standard for how all cameras must be required to implement. So the USB cameras basically implement whatever they want, and everything's done in the driver. The DC cameras, though, are nice because they force everybody to implement a certain set of interfaces across the FireWire bus. And so every FireWire camera you chuck on this laptop will work without any configuration or whatever. Whereas the USB cameras, you've got to stuff around, it probably won't even work, and there's a lot more problems with it. So the DC FireWire is really good for Linux because there's a standard for it that someone's been able to implement, and now every camera we buy can use it. So I'm a big FireWire fan. And as I said before, there are no USB 2 cameras yet, so if you want good quality video under Linux, FireWire is really your only choice at the moment. The USB cameras, the quality on them is a bit too poor, and the image is just nothing compared to the FireWire cameras. So, so I've bet the farm on the DC cameras. They're a little bit more expensive. That green camera I've got there costs about $200, but it's a nice camera, and it's still relatively cheap. I've got other cameras that cost about $1,000. But, you know, the odds of getting a $50 camera that's USB and making it work are a lot lower. So your mileage may vary. The cool part about the RGB 24 mode is that you can take the images directly from the camera and just pass it straight onto the video card. So video comes in via DMA, just copy the buffer straight into the OpenGL card, and then the card takes it off and does whatever it wants with it. There's very little work done on your part in the CPU. So the RGB frames are quite large because they don't have any compression. However, the CPU isn't used much, and the CPU is more precious than the bandwidth, so we can afford to waste some bandwidth. The USB cameras tend to operate in YUV mode, so they use compression to try to get as much data across the very small bus as they can, but the images look terrible. There's a program called Coriander, which you can use to play with video cameras, and all the devices that implement FireWire have nice controls. So if I So that's the Coriander program, and that if you turn it off, you can put it on. Okay, and the other thing to note is that the GC cameras, I found them to be more robust and reliable in general. So the CPIA driver used to crash on me a lot and stuff like that, whereas the FireWire stuff just seems to be a lot more mature. I think the reason is that the FireWire stuff is generic and it's used by everybody, whereas the CPIA driver for that particular camera is probably used by like two people, one of them being me. And so if there's a problem with it, there probably aren't that many people that care about it, whereas the FireWire stuff, there are probably 100 people using that, but at least all 100 people are sharing the same code base, so that helps to keep things working well. So the FireWire stuff is being actively maintained. I mean, there's a website, www.linux1394.org, which has a lot of FireWire stuff on it. They're the people who wrote the drivers. And so that seems to be pretty active, whereas the video for Linux stuff tends to be a bit more quieter. So just some extra hints to sort of, there are a few things with video for Linux, video 1394 that isn't talked about very often. If you have trouble with your cameras, I guess the first thing to try to do is to reload all the 1394 modules. There's a script in the add-on section to the CD-ROM that I've given that has a script called 1394 reset, and what it does is it RM mods all the modules and then puts them all back in again to give the FireWire system a kick if it needs it, because sometimes it gets a bit stuck where it won't detect the cameras. That used to happen more in the older versions. I haven't seen it so much nowadays, but it could be useful if you're having problems. The problem I have with my backpack is I'm outside. You're doing a demo to all these people and then something dies, and so I've got all these shell scripts off of menus that I can just click and restart the FireWire bus, restart this, restart that, because you can't really afford to reboot the laptop or whip a keyboard out and start debugging stuff. So that's one thing. The other thing that's a good idea is actually get the camera, disconnect it and stick it back in again, and that it could redetect it. Because we had a glitchy cable on one of our cameras, which was hopefully fixed, but the cable glitched in such a way that the hub noted the camera as being disconnected, but the cable was still in there, and so you had to remove it and stick it back in again. And even if you rebooted the machine, it still wouldn't detect it, because the actual hub itself had turned the device off permanently. So there are a few little things like that where if you stick devices in and out, you can try to fix things like that up. It's important that you configure your devices correctly depending on the kernel and the libdc version that you use. So there was a point in 2.4 series, which I think was at 2.4.17 and 2.4.18, where they changed the magic numbers that were used to represent the FireWire devices. So from 2.4.17 and 2.4.18, they changed the magic numbers. The libdc library has two versions, version 8 and version 9. Version 8 comes with Debian stable, and version 9 comes with Debian testing and unstable and Nopix. Version 9 is the one you should be using if you're playing with FireWire, because version 8 had problems. Version 8 also doesn't do multiple cameras well. We did some work last year using multiple cameras, like three or four FireWire cameras simultaneously, and version 8 of the DC libraries couldn't support it. So definitely need to use version 9. And so if you're using version 9 with the latest kernel 2.4, you need to run this command, /0/171.16. The older kernels used 172.0, and the old DC version 8 libraries used a different directory structure for video for Linux, for video 1394. This one here is the one you should be doing, because you should be using the latest 2.4 kernel and you should be using the latest libdc library. My notes have in detail the four possible configuration cases, and on the CD-ROM there's a script called make devices, which will make the correct MacNod commands depending on which kernel version and which libdc version you're using. So I'll leave that if you're interested in it. But you should be using that one up top. Also, you need a device called DevRaw 1394, which typically comes configured properly with most recent distributions. And that one's on /char/major/171-0. So if you do that command there, it'll create it. But you shouldn't have to do that, probably. So these are the two killer problems that we've discovered. And they just changed the versions arbitrarily at some point. I'm not sure why they did it the old way or whatever, but that's the way it is. So make sure you get that right. Otherwise, you'll have problems with your video. So those are the two devices that you need. What I'll do is I'll just quickly show the example code that I wrote for the 1394 camera. Okay, so this here is the interface code for the 1394 camera. This one here uses the AR Toolkit. So AR Toolkit has a library that captures video, and all I did is wrote a simple wrapper around it. So the open 1394 function simply calls AR Toolkit's AR2VideoOpen, pretty easy. It then calls the inquire size method to ask it for the width and height of the video that's been allocated. I then configure my app based on that. AR2VideoCapStart simply tells it to start the firing capturing process off. AR2VideoCapNext tells it to grab the next frame. And AR2VideoGetImage returns a frame. So this is a pretty simple way of writing code. So if you don't really want to get your hands dirty writing V4L or 1394 code, you can use this here. And this code here will also talk to a video for Linux camera as well, if you've compiled AR Toolkit correctly. And AR Toolkit, actually, while we're here, I'll just bring that up as well. Okay. If we go to the AR Toolkit directory, copy it so I don't break mine still. Compiling our toolkit's really simple. At the top level, you can see there's a configure script. Type /configure. It brings up a bunch of options. Video for Linux, DV camcorder, or digital camera. So you can choose the format you want. So if we want to compile it for video for Linux, we hit 1, hit enter. It builds some make files. Make clean, make, and it just builds it for you. And that's basically all you have to do. So AR Toolkit's really simple to play with, and I'll just go to one of the lib directories in a minute to show you some of the directories that are there. Okay, so that's compiled. So now, if you go into the lib directory, Okay. if you're in the libsource directory, these are the different libraries they provide.
Damn, I can't read the writing.
There we go. Okay. So the AR library is responsible for doing augmented reality vision tracking, where it extracts fiducial markers off the out of the video frame. AR Multi is a similar version that does multiple markers simultaneously. GL is the OpenGL interface that they use. Video Linux 1394 CAM is the API, it's a little set of functions they've written to abstract away the 1394 camera code. This one is for the DV cameras. This one's for V4L. And there's also a version for SGI and for Windows 32 as well. So these five APIs here, I've actually just used them as video capturing libraries as well because I didn't really feel like writing my own. So you can just take those video capture libraries if all you want to do is write a video capture app. So that demo program that I gave has a lot more in there that you can look at. So what we'll now move on to is talking about the AR Toolkit stuff, which is quite cool. Okay, so we're going to talk about vision tracking using AR Toolkit. So before we showed a quick demo of AR Toolkit running, now we're going to go through how it works roughly. So video cameras we can use to capture the physical world. So the video camera can see, capture an image, and it can then extract out features. Now, the trick is with vision tracking is you've got to lock on to features that are useful in the image. So as humans, we lock on to all kinds of things. We lock on to faces, corners, edges, and so forth. The problem with computers is vision is an artificial intelligence problem, it's a processing problem, there's all these problems all converge in. So with a computer, it's like, you know, it's looking around this room and it sees that, but is that a window or is that a box or whatever? And it's a very difficult problem for computers to extract out useful information from an image. So to make the vision tracking task simpler, what we're doing is like markers like these that have a very known and a known shape that we can place into the environment so the camera can find them. Because if you place this into a video frame, the computer looks and it, when it finds a huge white patch, if it looks for a black patch in the middle with a pattern in it, it goes, hey, that's a marker, I recognize that. Whereas if you just use arbitrary shapes like this bottle, and if you rotate it like this, you cause problems because it's changing shape and it looks funny from different angles. Whereas this pattern here is very simple, and it's much easier to write code that can track this than it is to write code that can track this. So AR Toolkit uses these to simplify itself. However, it's not the best toolkit in the world for tracking. There are much better vision tracking toolkits available, but the problem is they're not open source. You can't get access to them without paying a lot of money. So AR Toolkit's free beer and free and freedom, so you can use it for whatever you want and you can play with it and do whatever. And it allows computer to find stuff. Now, the other thing about vision tracking is that, you know, people have talked a lot about vision tracking for years. Oh, you know, we can use vision tracking for this and that. But it's very rare that you actually see anything doing vision tracking. So this is one of the first things I've seen where you can just use vision tracking and play with it without having to do too much stuff, and you can make interesting applications with. So that's what we're going to talk about. So AR Toolkit's a really nice library because it had that simple demo that I showed before with a cube on the marker. You can spin it around, look at it, you can put a VRML object on there, whatever you want. It's a very good base to start hacking with. So what we're going to do now is we're going to talk about how AR Toolkit works and how some examples and so forth. So the way AR Toolkit works is the first thing it does is it catches the video frame from the video camera. So it has an image with this in it somewhere. The way AR Toolkit works actually is you can trim the marker away from just a small white border. You just need a little bit of white, not too much. So the first thing it does is it thresholds the entire image. So it gets every pixel and either makes it black or white, depending on how bright it is. So if the pixel's bright, it makes it white. If the pixel's sort of dim, it makes it black. So that's the first pass. So now the image is just binary 1010. The next step is it does an edge detector. So what it does is it goes across the image and it tries to find all the solid regions that are all joined to each other. And it uses a filling technique. And it goes through the image and attempts to identify each solid shape in the image. Once it's identified each solid shape, it passes them through a line detector, which attempts to see if it can find four edges and four corner points. If it finds a blob that has four corners and it has four reasonably straight lines, it then figures, well, I've probably got a pattern that I could see. So then what it does is it grabs the outline of the marker and it unwarps it to flatten it out. It then tries to grab the center of the pattern out, and then it looks up this part against the database that it has internally of patterns available. So what happens is, to calibrate the software, you point the camera at the marker, it captures the image and saves it to the hard drive stored in four rotations, and then when you present the marker to the software, it grabs the image and it compares it against all of the images that are stored in memory, and it finds a match. It then goes, okay, I've found the hero pattern, and it returns you back to the handle for the hero pattern. You can have multiple markers simultaneously, so you can have a hero, you can have a triangle, you can have a box, a square, a line, and you catch each one in and store it, so you've got to pre-recognize it, and then after AR Toolkit will match it and go, hey, this is the square pattern, this is the box. And you can have four or five markers simultaneously in the same view. So in my glove tracking example that I showed before, we had two hands moving around. They had separate markers, and that way our toolkit's able to distinguish left from right by using separate patterns. And one triangle, you'll notice here, is the exact opposite of the other triangle. One's white triangle on black, the other one's black triangle on white. They're completely binary opposite from each other, which tries to minimize collisions. If you had a marker that said hero and another one that said hira, they look so similar that our toolkit may potentially confuse the markers. The trick is to try to make them look as different as possible. AR Toolkit uses a 16 by 16 grid to sample the interior image, and so it's important to remember that this image is going to be mangled, and when it's stored in the internal database of markers that it knows about. You can store about 10 or so markers, or maybe 20. Anything more than that and the thing starts to fall apart, because there's so many markers that it has to compare against that the software gradually slows down. And the more markers you throw at it, then the complexity shoots up and then it starts to become unusable. So the trick is to try not to put as many markers as possible. You've got to try to cut that down. After it's matched against the pattern database, it uses the edges to calculate its rotation, and it knows the size of the marker so it can calculate its distance based on how small it is, and it uses all this information to provide you X, Y, and Z coordinates, as in where it is in the frame, and it also uses it to provide the rotation, so heading, pitch, and roll. So you can use that to reconstruct it. After it's computed that, it then gives you a matrix, which is a 4x4 collection of numbers, which you can then extract out the values that you want. What we'll do is we'll quickly go through the simple test application. Simple test is that example program I showed you with the cube overlaid on it. So we'll just quickly go through that. Our toolkit code is actually quite... there's almost no comments or anything like that, so it can be a bit hairy to sort of look at. So the trick here, if we look at the start, this is the main loop function which does most of the work. I won't go to the rest of it because it's pretty straightforward. But we start off, it simply grabs an image from the camera, so it sucks in an image. It waits for a little while for whatever particular reason. They initialize the OpenGL camera to be a two-dimensional view. They then display the image to the display. So they draw the background video onto the display, so it's ready to go. Because now we're going to draw the 3D annotation on top of it. So they then call the function rDetectMaster, and they pass in the video image data pointer. So you take your video image, which is a 640 by 480 frame, and you just dump it at our detect marker. It takes in an RGB with 28 bits per pixel, RGB. You pass in a threshold value, which is like 0.5 or 0.8 or something. That's the threshold that's used to decide whether a pixel is black or white when it makes the image binary. And you can vary that threshold depending on the lighting conditions that you're dealing with. in very bright conditions or very dark conditions, you may have to fiddle with it to get it to work right. I've got to do some work with my system, because in certain sunlight conditions, it just doesn't work very well. Ampersand marker info and marker num are the two buffers that return back the markers that are found. So marker info is an array of markers, and marker num is the number of markers that were successfully detected in the image. So that function goes off, crunches for a while. So this function is very intensive. It comes back with a set of markers. This then requests the next camera image to get it on its way. Now, they do some tests here to test if a certain marker is visible or not. We won't worry about that too much, because that's not relevant. They call... we go here to argetTransmat. So what argetTransmat does is it grabs each marker that's been detected, and it extracts out that 4x4 matrix, which is a series of numbers that tell you where the marker is. It pulls that out, and it then calls a draw function, which draws that cube on top of the display. So if we go to the draw function, here it is here. So this is the function that actually draws the cube. It sets up a 3D view, it does a bunch of GL commands to initialize the display, it converts the matrix and loads it all in, it sets up some lighting for the cube, it translates the cube into the right position on the thing. Glut solid cube is the function that's responsible for dumping the cube onto the display. What? Ooh. I've got to put on charge. Okay. And GL para here is where the camera is programmed so that the viewpoint is set so that the cube renders on top of the our toolkit marker. So, actually, let me just get my charger out. What happens is, that's happy. Okay. When the detect marker function extracts out the position for the object, when the AR detect marker function returns, it returns back where the marker is relative your camera, your head. So it returns back how far it is away from you, how X and Y would be coordinates are relative to you, and it also has the rotation necessary to put it into the correct orientation. So that's the first step, is working out where the marker is relative to you. The next step is setting up the OpenGL camera so that it's here where your head is, and then using that transformation to put the box at the same place where the marker was when you detected it. So you're doing the reverse of what you did before, and then drawing the cube at the location where you detected the cube to be. And so then it puts it in. So this part here, this code there, which is GL matrix mode model view, that's saying to OpenGL, we're getting ready to reprogram where you are now. And then the next part, load matrix D, GL para. GL para is the matrix that came from our toolkit, and now it's pushing it into OpenGL. And OpenGL shifts itself so that the cube lands on the right spot. OpenGL programming is another tutorial in itself, which I don't have enough time to talk about. The examples go through in a bit more detail how to do it. And if you're interested in playing with this more, if you really want to get into it, you're going to have to learn some OpenGL programming, so I'd advise you to read the Red Book. Otherwise, you can hack with this program, but the modifications you can make are quite simple unless you start understanding more about GL. Has anyone else got any questions before we continue? Okay. So that's roughly how this program works. And that's the simple test program, which is the demonstration application for our toolkit. So, okay, So computer graphics uses 4x4 matrices to represent translation, scaling, rotation, and any other operation you can do with a polygon or whatever. They can be easily combined and handled in hardware. The video accelerator cards have the ability to multiply 4x4 matrices in hardware without using the CPU to do it. And our toolkit computes its result as a 4x4 matrix. So we're going to talk a little bit about it. And it's stored using row column notation in C. So if you want to access a certain element, row number, column number. And it's represented as an array that looks like that. Now, if you want to take a 3D object here and do nothing with it, you can multiply it by the identity matrix. It looks like that. It's got ones going across its diagonal. If you take a point and multiply it by that, the point will stay where it is. If you take this matrix here, 1, 1, 1, 1, and it's got TX, TY, TZ there, if you put, say, 5, 0, and 0 in those spots, if you take a 3D object and push it through this matrix, the object will shift 5 units to the right. So by fiddling with TX, TY, and TZ, you can make an object move around and go wherever you want. If you want to scale an object, where SX, SY, and SZ are, you can make an object bigger and smaller using those three values. Now, talking about matrix mathematics is beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about today. It's quite complicated, but the Red Book talks quite a lot about it. If you want to get the translation from AR Toolkit, let's say you want just the X, Y, and Z values from the AR Toolkit matrix. You grab the matrix from AR Toolkit matrix and do square bracket 0, square bracket 3, and store it in a variable called X. You do the same for Y and Z. If you take the results from our toolkit and do this to it, that will tell you the X, Y, and Z coordinates of where the marker is in your frame. So I used this technique when I did my glove tracker. I wanted to find out where the glove was relative to my face. If you do those three lines of code there, that will extract out the X, Y, and Z coordinates. If you want to pull rotation out of that matrix, it's very difficult to do unless you know a lot about linear algebra, so we won't talk about that. But this is a simple thing you can do. The notes talk a bit more about it. So this is how you would go about extracting out the X, Y, and Z coordinates. So in that previous example, just where it was loading into OpenGL the matrix, if you put some code in there that grabs out the X, Y, and Z values using this here, you can then print those out, pass them on, send them over a UDP socket, whatever you want to do. So you can use our toolkit as a generic tracker to pass things on. So as I said before, I use our toolkit to track my hands. So in that previous video you saw with me moving my hands around, the marker on the tip of my thumbs was being tracked using our toolkit. So we place two markers on each thumb. Our toolkit detects where they are. It extracts out the XYZ coordinates. I then use OpenGL to calculate what the 2D coordinates of those 3D cursors are, and then we now have the ability to point at stuff on the display. So, and this is what I use it for, but you know, what other kinds of stuff could we use it for? I mean, some of the things that you might want to go away and think about are, you know, mounting a video camera on either your head or on top of your monitor, and then attaching markers to your thumbs, and then can you use it to select GUI options in GNOME or KDE? Perhaps you could write a mouse driver for it so it emulates a standard serial mouse so that it can hook into X Windows. Could you use it to steer your desktop and stuff like that instead of using a mouse? I mean, these are some kind of things you might want to hack up at home to sort of have a play around with some of the kind of things you can do with vision tracking. I mean, those are just some examples I can think of off the top of my head. You know, I'd just be interested to see what other people are capable of coming up with as well. So, it's quite simple to extract this kind of stuff because our toolkit does a lot of the dirty work for us. You know, there's a lot of potential here. The other thing we did, Ben Avery, one of my students, he did a project last year where we took our toolkit and we modified it to turn it into a tracking system. So what we did was we placed fiducial markers all over the ceiling of our lab, and then we had three video cameras on the shoulders, on the head, all looking up onto the ceiling. So as you walk around, our toolkit detects where you are relative to the markers. And then by knowing where each marker is by building up a model of the room, the computer can then calculate where in the room you're standing. So instead of buying a $20,000 magnetic tracker, you can spend 6 weeks putting up markers everywhere and measuring them with a tape measure nicely. and you can trade time for money. But you can walk around with a backpack on and you can track where you are in a room. And it's accurate to within 10 or 20 centimeters when you're walking around. So, you know, this way costs nothing except for our time to go up, put the markers up, and to have three cameras mounted on our body to walk around with. But it gives you the ability to track where you are in a room. Another alternative is you put a big foam block on your head with four IR toolkit markers on it, and you put a camera in the corner of the room. So as you walk around, the camera watches you in the room, it calculates your XYZ coordinates relative to where you are. So as you walk towards the coffee pot, it starts it up for you, or as you walk towards the door, the lights come on. I mean, you know, these are some of the kinds of things you could do. So, I mean, we haven't built that, but using our toolkit is very simple. And so by rotating different sides of your head towards the camera, it sees different patterns, and you can work out all kinds of interesting things, and you could put them on your hands, or I don't know, the sky's the limit. So there's lots of different things we can do. So this is one thing we explored playing with, and sort of it sort of works okay, but it is quite time consuming to set up the models and to get it all right. So that's something we did. Now, the next part we're going to talk about, actually before we continue, does anyone have any questions about some of the stuff we've talked about before? Yeah. Yep. Okay, the problem with the cube is that if you bring your hand in and touch it, the cube disappears because the marker gets blocked out. So the trick is trying to have it, what you have to do is you have the marker over here and you have another marker on your hand. And I've seen projects where people do that, where as you move the marker closer to the object, then it does things. The people who wrote our toolkit actually built this demo, which was, it was like a memory game where they had 16 markers all face down. And as you turned them over, they flipped up to reveal little three-dimensional objects. So one of them you flipped over and it was like an alien. And if you flip the other one with the spaceship and brought them together, then it would do some little dance and fly around and stuff like that. And so if you actually Google for AR Toolkit, there's tons of apps that people have written with it to do different little things like that. Little games and just, it's just a cool demo kind of thing that you can show to people really easily. And, you know, you can put a HMD or even a monitor and just show it to a kid. And within 2 seconds, they can work out how to use it because it's very tangible. There's no mouse, no keyboard, no shortcuts, no command line options. You just grab it and start moving things around and flipping things over. The toolkit does have certain limitations of what you can do with it. The trick is trying to work around them. Like, if you wanted to point at an object, what you would do is you would have a marker on your thumb, say, and then have like a virtual pointing stick coming off it, and the tip of the pointing stick is the bit that actually touches it. So the trick is trying to keep your hands away from the marker and having it pointed long enough that your thumb never gets in the way. Because the second your hand gets on the top, then it falls apart. There are ways you can get around it, such as having two or three markers and having them small enough so that if you cover one marker, the other two are still visible, like have backup markers. There are lots of different ways you can get around it. You could do that. The only problem with that, I actually used that in my glove for my modeling, in that if the hands are in view, the model is placed in front of you, whereas if your hands are down by your waist and you can't see them, and the model is placed at your feet. The problem that you have, though, is you're holding your hands out, and just as you create the object, the sunlight changes or the angle changes and it loses detection, and then the object is put at your feet instead of out in front of you. And the AR toolkit's very glitchy. Like, when you use it outside, it tends to cut in and out quite a lot. And like, when I was using it, as you're moving it around, it would be okay to use it for state changes, but you'd want to be very careful how you do it. Like, you wouldn't want to have it so that when you turn the marker over, it RMs your hard drive or something like that. You'd want something a bit more robust than that. Like, you know, you'd have to flip it over 4 times or, I don't know, something. The trick would be to try to make sure you cover yourself so that you can handle the glitches. Because that's the reason I designed my menuing system the way I did, was to try to get around the lack of accuracy and the tracking. A mouse is a super accurate device that you can move pixel by pixel, whereas this vision tracker is very coarse and it's jittery and it's just not as accurate. So you have to make sure you design your user interface with those limitations in mind. Yeah, after this talk, when we finish during the lunch break, we'll take some of them back outside and we can have a play with it. So if anyone's interested in playing the Quake game, we can maybe go with that. Yeah, I'll be back. Yeah, I mean, okay, the thing with our toolkit is the only reason we use it is because it's free and because it does something really mean that we don't have otherwise. If you were going to use this for real, there are a lot better features coming out in our toolkit. Like, there are ways that you can find it, you can code class codes into the central master to avoid having to get stuck against the database. So there are a lot of ways you can improve our performance and hardware and different algorithms. The only reason we're using it in our toolkit is because it's the only one we can get and we can play with for free. So our toolkit is not the best case solution, but it is nice because we can play with it relatively easily. So there are other ways of doing tracking, and using hardware would be the way to go because it's quite CPU intensive. You know, you can burn up Pentium 2 just doing machine tracking, whereas you really need CPU for other tasks as well. So the P3 laptop manages to run our toolkit and rendering software and detects multiple assignments and easily. But if you start trying to ramp up the number of markers, everything starts to clag out a bit. So having even separate hardware would be better. And also in something like custom logic, you can implement a lot of CPU tracking algorithms a lot better and more efficiently than you could do in a general purpose processor. Yeah. Yep. That's okay. What happens is when you define the model for your cube, like if you, let's say you're drawing your cube in 3D Studio Max, that cube there was created at the origin at 0, 0. All you do is click the cube, drag it 50 centimeters to the right, save it out, and then put it in. And what will happen is when you place the markers down, the cube will appear 50 centimeters to the right. However, the catch with our toolkit is it appears as though the cube is floating in the correct place, but it's actually more of an illusion. The cube's actually moving all over the shop, and it's vibrating. And if you look at it, it actually vibrates over about 10 to 15 degrees. So if you've got an object that's a meter away, and you hold it, it'll actually be vibrating on a 10 degrees. And so the further the object's away from the marker, you get these lever arm effects, where it's like at the end of a fishing pole. It's very small here, but at the end of the fishing pole, it's moving around quite a lot. Keep it close to the marker. Like that pointing example I talked about before, we had a marker on the fingertip and points with it. That actually starts to fall apart. The pointer ends up doing this, and it's not as usable as you'd like. That's why I use a pointer like that, because our toolkit's very good at estimating the center point of the fiducial, but it's not very good at getting the rotation right. So relying on just the center point is a very accurate way of pointing at an object, because it doesn't dance around so much. But if you're using the rotation, it magnifies the distance. So yeah. You have a question? Okay, the way we do it currently is it has a beep when you press it. So when you select it, it goes beep, and when you've picked an option, then you let go. We have it that way because there's a delay that you have to hold your finger for before it does it, because the gloves are a bit glitchy, and so there's a potential you could tap really quickly, and you don't want to do that, so you have to click, click, and you have to wait a certain amount of time. We haven't looked too much into it. The other thing we're also looking at is integrating speech recognition as well. We think that would be a good idea because the menuing system only has 10 menu options available at any time, and you really need more than that, because doing a single operation, there's 8 or 9 commands sitting there all the time. And it'd be nice to have about 20 others available as well. Like, you know, you're dragging an object around, it'd be nice to change its color as well. But you run out of menu options really quickly. and then you're having to start nest them, and then you've got 10 levels deep, and it becomes too hard to navigate through. So there are problems with that too, yeah. The modeling system. Yeah. I mean, we have the ability to load VRML models into our modeling software, and you can take in a 100,000 polygon object, load it in, and look at it in place. It all can be done. The technology is good enough today to do it. The problem is developing this into a format that is reliable enough that it won't break, no dodgy cables, no kernel panics, no nothing. Like, it has to be perfect. Like a VCR, you just press the plane, it just works. I mean, it's not very often that your video recorder crashes on you. That's the first problem. The second problem is miniaturizing everything and selling it cheap enough. Because most people aren't willing to spend $20,000 to develop a backpack that they can do this kind of stuff with. The people we see initially as being most interested in are people with a lot of money. So people with, if you've got a mining company, these people spend $1 billion pulling it out of the ground. For them, spending 20 grand on a visualization tool to help them with their work, it's not really a problem. Whereas a real estate agent is at the other end of the spectrum, where they might just have the 20 grand or maybe not. And then you've got people like us who can't justify 20 grand for something like that at all. So the trick, I guess, is starting with the people at the top and working its way down. I mean, that's how computers evolved and so forth. The military bought millions of them, and they drove the price down for us, people like us. And so over time, as things become more useful, people see a need for it. Then someone like Sony comes along and goes, hey, this is the greatest thing in the world. Let's just make one of these in a PlayStation 2 with a HMD on it and sell it for $500. Because they probably could do it if they wanted to, but they just have to throw money at it. And that's the problem. It's not the technology as such, it's the fact that someone needs to go, yes, we're going to do this, and yes, we're going to throw $100 million at it to make it happen. Because then stuff becomes cheap. If you're only selling two of them, then they're expensive because you're only selling two. So it's a quantity of scale thing. So. We've done a lot of work playing around with viewing models and things like that. But to actually sell it to people is, I don't think you'll see that for another couple of years until the equipment becomes cheaper. And it's getting there. The other thing, people look at the backpack and go, oh my God, that thing is too heavy. It is. It weighs 15 kilos, so. Yeah, these are some of the kinds of issues that we're doing. No, basically my work with my thesis was focused on developing user interfaces for it. So basically I just used our toolkit because it was there and that's it. What I am doing now is I'm starting, we're doing work with using coloured ping pong balls and detecting those instead as just a single coloured blob. We're going to see how that works out. Yes, you can improve the quality of vision using multiple cameras. There are people that have demonstrated these kind of systems, but you can't get access to their code. So the reason I'm talking about our toolkit today is because it's something that everybody can play with, whereas if we talk about proprietary systems that we wouldn't be able to use them. So our toolkit is not the best solution, but it is still a reasonable thing that we can play with. But if you want better accuracy, you're going to have to develop your own vision tracker. Something like that. Other questions? Yeah. The wiring harness one. Yeah, Boeing did something about, might have been 5 or 6 years ago, where they had workers with computers worn on their belts, and they'd head-mounted displays that, as they were setting up wiring looms for aircraft, the computer would draw in where the wires would go, so that they could see instructions. So rather than having a piece of paper and then doing it and looking at the paper, it projected the instructions onto your field of view so you could see it. I know that they built prototypes and they tested it, but it never went anywhere. I don't think they actually use it in production. It's more of a prototype that they played with. One of the biggest problems with it was that people thought they looked dorky when they were wearing it. And so they asked all these questions like, what do you think about it? And I was like, oh, it's crap, it's crap. And so they didn't really get any useful feedback because a lot of people were just against it for the fact that it looked dumb, not that it actually helped them with their job. So the results they got from it were a bit, they weren't quite sure, but yeah. The problem with a lot of the SGI stuff is, like, we got given all these boxes a while back from the Center for Manufacturing, and the software license on it was just incredible. Like, they've got these licensed servers, and everything costs this and that. And the boxes are actually almost useless now because they all had time-based licenses, and the software just stopped working after a couple of years. So now the boxes are almost crippled to the point where they're not usable, which is sort of sad because over time, the companies that sold it don't even care about it anymore. You can't use it. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And it's sort of, that's the really hardcore commercial Unix is like, especially like SGIs, when they sold these big rendering packages and stuff, they're so encumbered by licensing that even when you try to use them legitimately, the license service cause problems and get in the way and die on you. And I can't believe anyone actually uses that kind of stuff, because if it dies and you've got a movie you've got to finish by tomorrow, you know, no one's going to fly out and fix it for you. So, yeah, I don't know, it's an interesting thing. So, anyway, I better move on. I'll just talk about this custom hardware section, and then later on, if we've got time, we can go through any more questions. So I probably should keep moving on. Okay, so custom hardware. So this is the fun part you've all been waiting for. Hacking is it's about software. I've said this at the talk last year, and the year before, and the year before that. What it is, it's also about using tools to modify your hardware and make cool new devices. So you get your laptop and you use drills, power saws, soldering irons, sticky tape, plastic and metal, make mods, stuff like that. And the cool part is you make lots of mistakes along the way, which costs a lot of money as well. So what you can do is you can combine your software hacking and your hardware hacking to even get more fun and pain and stress and everything else. Probably why I don't sleep at night. So the first thing I'm going to talk about before we start is a little project here called Project Oxcart. So what we did the other day was the laptop, the backpack case has a FireWire hub in it. And what it does is the Dell laptop only has a 4-pin power connector, a 4-pin FireWire connector, and that doesn't provide power to any external devices. So you need a hub to take 12 volts and provide 12 volts to all the devices, such as the cameras. So I thought, well, would it be a cool idea if I made up my own custom cable that took 12 volts, took a 4-pin connector, and just provided it for the camera? That way I wouldn't have to have the hub and more space. So that was a good idea. So we built the cable, worked. I flew over to New Zealand, did some demos, and then on the third day, the FireWire just stopped working. And I'm like, now what? And I thought, well, it must be a cable or something. So I took it home, and I threw all the hubs and cameras and everything out and got everything new and plugged it in the laptop. It still didn't work. And I tried it and tried it, and it wasn't software, it wasn't anything. It was just, we blew the FireWire controller chip. And we banged our head for ages against the wall trying to work out what happened. And it turns out that FireWire actually has a problem with it, where if you get a device, there was a lot of talk about Mac PowerBooks a long time ago because they provide power on their connectors. They've got 6-pin plugs. And if you stick a FireWire device in a couple hundred times, eventually it'll blow the controller chip up. And Apple replaced their chips, and there was a bit of a PR problem there. But the problem with the Dell is that it's got a 4-pin connector, but it's never designed to provide power. And by making this dodgy cable up, I was sort of providing the power for it. And when you plug a device in initially, what happens is you plug the device in, the 12 volt surges up the cable towards the camera. The camera then takes the voltage in, but because the voltage is still building up, it sends back a huge voltage spike down the data lines back to the computer. Now normally what happens is the hub would take that spike. But what happened was that because I wasn't using the hub anymore, the Dell FireWire chip took the spike instead. And it turns out the FireWire chip from the Dell wasn't as good enough as taking the spike as the hub was. So I toasted the chip. So the chip's in two halves. There's the half that talks to the PCI bus, there's the half that talks to the FireWire controller. That half was toasted. It has protection circuitry in it to protect the rest of your computer, but it's toasted the chip. So we did all this research, we looked around and we discovered that we thought this was probably what caused it. So the chip was called a TFB41AB1. You can see here, that's the chip there. It's a 5-cent piece. So it's super, super tiny. And that's the Dell motherboard there. Actually, this photo back here shows us operating on the motherboard. So the Dell motherboard is about that big, and the chip is a little tiny one in the corner. And you can see here, viewed through a microscope, the whole operation was performed through a microscope. So what happened was, is that's the chip there. It's got 64 pins on it. And we bought a new one from the US. We couldn't buy it from Australia because the chips are so rare that you have to buy them a minimum order 160 at $3 each. So we bought them from the US, $5 a piece. We bought five of them, so it arrived. So what we did was we ran a razor blade over each of the pins to break them all. And then we heated each pin up and used a dental pick to lift each pin up. And then as we lifted each pin up, that took about an hour and a half to do that, pulled the chip off. You then run the soldering iron over to clean all the pads up, clean it some more, put flux cleaner and everything on it. We then put the chip, so that was another 2 hours, and we put the chip back on, and you've got to get all the pins to align perfectly. So we put the chip back on, we then re-soldered every chip back again, every pin back again, then we cleaned it to make sure there was no lead going across the tracks or whatever. And then after about 8 hours of surgery in this soldering iron room, here's a picture of us demoing the new camera. So that's Aaron, Ross, and me. So we were the ones who did all this. So we spent about 8 hours in this room. So we saved about $1,200. I mean, in reality, if we were charging $20 an hour for the operation, we didn't really save all that much money. But it was the experience of doing it which was quite interesting, and the fact that we're able to fix the hardware because it's out of warranty. And it cost us $5 in parts. So you can actually fix your gear up. So I told all my friends that we're going to do this, and they're like, no, it won't work, and it works, so it's pretty cool. So, yeah, we scored a couple of legend points for that one. So that's my first example that I wanted to start off with, because I thought that was quite interesting. And, okay, so what I'm going to talk now about, that's not in the notes or anything like that, but it's on the website. If you Google for Project Oxcart 1394, it'll find it. Project Oxcart is actually what Lockheed Martin used to call the SR-71 stealth bomber when it was secret, because we wanted to keep it secret from everybody. Like, we didn't want to tell my boss about it in case he told us not to do it. So yeah. Anyway, so what we're going to talk about now is interfacing technology, how to build dongles to hook up to your computer. So on most computers, we have parallel ports, serial ports, and USB ports, also FireWire ports. And we have like PCI buses and stuff like that. So the thing with modern PCs though is that they're becoming more complex and faster, but the interfaces are also getting harder for hobbyists to play with. So back in the old days, serial ports and parallel ports were really easy, but gradually they're starting to be faded away. Like my laptop here does not have serial on it, it's got parallel, but you buy new computers nowadays that are legacy free, they have no serial, no parallel. So it's becoming harder and harder to make old school devices to plug in. Making USB components yourself is quite difficult because you have to implement the full USB spec, and the USB spec is like this fat and it's really complicated. So, you know, if you can make something really on the cheap, then that's really what we're about here. We don't want to spend 6 months making a USB controller. So PCI, USB and FireWire are all generally too complicated for us to play with unless you're some kind of circuit guru. However, there are a couple of nice interfacing chips out there that are quite nice to hack things with, so we're going to talk about those. The notes contain a lot of detailed instructions about how to talk to serial ports, parallel ports, and so forth. I won't be able to go through all that today, but have a read of those if you want to know anything more. So the first thing we'll talk about is the parallel port. The parallel port is a 25-pin printer connector on the back. It has 8 data lines that are capable of driving plus 5 volts at a very low current draw, so you can't power a fan off it or anything like that, but you can twiddle LED lights on and off. There's actually a cool little program called LED CPU Meter that used to be on sunsite.unc.edu, I found it off Google and I put it with the attachments on the CD-ROM. And what you can do is you start it up and you put 8 LEDs on your printer port, and then you can have Knight Rider style scanning effects with LEDs on your computer. And as the load average goes up, it can go faster and faster. Although the problem with it is that as the load average goes up, it hammers the CPU harder and harder to make the lights move quicker. And so it ends up strangling the computer when it runs too fast. So that's a catch of it. But anyway, it's quite a neat thing. I played with that in like 1995, back in the old days, so it's quite old school. But there are flow control lines you can also use to transport data. Old printer ports on very old computers don't have the ability to read data back in. Not all of them are bidirectional. So it's something to keep in mind. But you can definitely spray 8 bits out at a time. And some of the guys at work have a CNC mill that they control, which is a drill with motors controlling it that is steered using a parallel port. So it's quite cool. The problem with it is that the CPU has to bang out each byte manually. So if you want to flash the lights, you have to sit there with an instruction and write out each byte's port and hammer the computer. Now the problem with it is that it's very inefficient to have a super fast Pentium 4 writing I/O port things. And let's say you want to flash a light at a certain interval. You have to flash the light, then sleep, then flash the light. And when you sleep, you can't go into a kernel sleep. You actually have to hammer the CPU to burn the CPU cycles off, because the task switching overhead is so high that you might not be able to flip back to your program in time to get any work done. Linux is a non-real-time operating system, and so what it means is that if you ask the kernel to do something, it'll do it, but it'll get around to it when it feels like it. It won't do it when you want it to. So if you want to fly an aircraft automatically using an operating system, you can't use Linux to do it, not standard Linux anyway, because it could be that just as you want to bank the plane, it goes, oh, I've got to flush this log out, so it switches this log in, flushes out to disk, then maybe a second later it flicks back and goes, oh, so you want to fly an airplane, do you? Oh, whoops. So there are patches to Linux called real-time patches which allow you to do things where you can say to the kernel, look, this has to run now and you have to promise me you'll do it. And the kernel goes, I promise you I'll do it, but I'll do it at the detriment of your I/O performance and everything else. So there's a trade-off you have to make between performance and timeliness. Linux, by default, does not do timeliness. Actually, the best real-time operating system ever invented is DOS, of all things, because it doesn't do anything. So you can take full control of the CPU and bang the bits as fast or as slow as you like. So the CNC mill software we use is a DOS program, because there's nothing in the way. You try to run it into Windows, it clags up. Linux has got the same issue. You need to use the real-time patches to make it work. So these are some things to keep in mind. Now the next thing is, if you want to swallow data off the printer port, that's also the same problem, because the computer has to constantly pull the port going, is there data, is there data, is there data, is there data, is there data? And if there isn't, then the CPU's burnt time away doing it. So printer ports aren't really ideal, but if you're doing something where you just want to flick something on here, flick something on there or whatever, it's quite reasonable to do that, so it's pretty easy. But in most cases, it burns the CPU away too much, so you need to do something else. So the alternative is a serial connector, which is the RS-232 port, which is used to hook modems up to and so forth. Now, the serial port can go up to 115,200 baud, so it's slower than a parallel port. A parallel port is 8 bits wide, so it can really jam data down it. But you can jam data only by slowing the computer down. Serial ports have hardware that assists you with the transfer of the data. So the UART chip on board will take 16 bytes of data from the kernel and then stream it out to the serial port, and the kernel can go and do its own thing. And because the Linux kernel is delayed and it's buffering and everything like that, the Linux kernel can batch up collections of serial data, throw it at the serial chip, then go and do some other work, and then the serial chip will send an interrupt when new data has arrived. So the serial port is a much more efficient way of doing data transfer, and that's what makes it possible to hook a lot of modems up to a computer, and you can flatline them all and the computer will happily transfer the data, is because if there's big enough buffers, then the kernel can work well. Kernels don't work well when the buffers are super tiny, and that's the problem with the printer port. So serial ports are really cool to hook up with. There's only 3 wires, so it's quite nice, and the kernel programming interface is quite nice as well. The notes talk quite a lot in detail as to how to set up a serial port to send data back and forth. You basically open the port up, do a couple of ioctls to program the baud rate you want and the transfer type, and then you just start doing read, write, or whatever you want. So it's pretty straightforward to send data to it. And the kernel does all the buffering. However, you need hardware at the other end in order to handle the marshalling of the data. So let's say you want to have a thing that can turn some LED lights on and off. The serial port is able to transport data, but when it gets outside, you then need to have some device that reads the serial data and then turns lights on and off to make that happen. So the best way to do that is you bang a little microcontroller on the end of it to make it do this. So there's a chip you can get called a Basic Stamp 2, which is really easy to program. They've written a lot of nice APIs for it so that you can write really simple programs that just say turn light on, read from serial port, read the data, and it's written using this weird basic like syntax. The glove controller I actually use in my backpack. It sends 5 volts up each finger, and it then listens for which whether it comes back from the thumb or the palm is implemented using a Basic Stamp 2. Now the cool part about this is that the Basic Stamp 2 is constantly hammering, just testing each finger repeatedly, over and over and over again. The thing does about it does 30 updates per second on 8 fingers. So it sends, it's constantly pulsing each finger to detect if any of the fingers are pressed. The cool part about a Basic Stamp though is the chip is quite cheap and it runs off a 9-volt battery for a couple of days. So it's very power efficient. And what it can do is you can offload the expensive processing off of your laptop onto the Basic Stamp 2. If we had a laptop with a parallel port driving my gloves, a Pentium 4 CPU, which is burning 100 and something watts of power, has to burn through and pulse these wires, and the computer's just spinning its wheels doing nothing. Instead, we can use a cheap microcontroller that's very power efficient to do all of that work for us. And then when the controller detects something has changed, it sends a single serial byte back to the computer saying, hey, this finger got pressed. And the computer goes, oh, finger pressed. Okay, I'll deal with it. But all of the expensive processing of banging the pins on the gloves is all done in hardware for us. So using a microcontroller can help make our things a lot more efficient. So in the case of that Knight Rider flashing light example, the better way to do it would be for the computer to send a load average once per second via the serial port to the microcontroller, and the microcontroller then adjusts the flashing light accordingly. The nice part about that is that as the computer becomes slower and slower and slower, the microcontroller can make the lights go faster and faster because it's a separate CPU. So it's like hardware acceleration, except it's for something simple like that. So the Basic Stamp 2 is quite cool to program. The only catch with it though is that the development tools only run under Windows. So what you do is you boot Windows, you write the code, upload it, and then once you've done that, you never have to use them ever again, so it doesn't matter. So my glove controller, once it's been programmed, it stores in flash memory the little program that it runs, and whenever you turn it on, it does what it does. So they're quite nice. They're easy to program, and you can buy them at Dick Smith's and stuff. The alternative is that you buy a more hardcore microcontroller, but then you're going to have to make your own boards, and you have to start programming in assembly language or C, and it becomes a bit more difficult. So those are quite nice. They're about $50, I think, you can buy them for. So I could recommend those. The problem with serial ports on a computer is that there are only a couple serial ports available. Like my laptop doesn't have any, that laptop has one, and if you need to plug in 5 devices, what do? There are 2 things you can do. You can run PCMCIA cards that have serial ports on them, but the problem with those is that you've only got 2 PCMCIA slots, and so you can only add 2 ports. That doesn't really solve the problem. What you can do though is there are these USB to serial converters that you can buy that work under Linux quite well. There are 2 particular ones that I recommend you use. There are KeySpan converters, which Hugh Blemmings wrote the driver for, and he's here, and he also talked about it a couple of years ago. He talked to KeySpan, they gave him the specs, and they work with him to write the drivers for it, and they're really good. So we have a KeySpan box in the backpack there, which talks to Linux quite well. And it's in the standard kernel as well. So any 2.4 and above kernel has a KeySpan driver built in. There's also another wicked chip called an FTDI FT8U232AM. Now, the KeySpan converters are quite expensive, but this chip here costs about $10 if you buy the chips. And they're about $40 or $50 if you buy them in little boards made up. So what we're going to do is when we build the next generation backpack, we're going to embed the FTDI chip in every device we have, so that we can throw away all our serial ports completely and just have everything USB enabled. So the glove controller, instead of having a serial port coming off it, it'll have a single USB powered thing, where it does serial over USB, and it'll also leech power off the USB bus as well, so we can cut down the number of cables. So the FTDI device is quite nice because it's a single chip, it provides all of USB to serial conversion, and it's got a kernel driver as well. Many of the other USB to serial drivers you'll buy in stores will not work under Linux because they use a non-standard chip. There is no standard interface for serial under Linux, and so the only ones I know for sure that work are the FTDI and the Keyspan ones. And you have to make sure you purchase carefully when you're buying these things. So that's a little bit of a hint. And the cool part about them is when you stick them in, they just appear as a DevTDY USB 0 or something. And they look just like a serial port. The kernel abstracts everything away. So the actual programming model is quite nice. This is a lot nicer than having to build your own USB device, implement your own protocol, then having to write your own kernel driver and everything like that. I mean, you really don't want to go messing around in kernel space if you can avoid it, because it's not very friendly in that part of town. So best thing to do is, if you use these, someone else has written the driver and you can just use them. So we've started playing with the FTDI chips, and it looks quite good. The next thing you can do, you can buy these dumb controller boxes that plug in via USB. Now what they do is you stick them in. I don't know if they work under Linux, I've never really used them, but they have the ability where the computer here can set pins on and off to turn lights on and off and so forth. The problem with those is that the computer is doing the work. What you really want to try to do is offload as much of the work as possible onto a separate microcontroller. The microcontroller provides real-time functionality, because the microcontroller doesn't have syslog running or anything like that. It's just spinning away, doing whatever it has to do, and so it can report the data back to the kernel on the CPU when it's ready, and the laptop can go and do other things like texture mapping, video, and so forth. So computers are designed to do certain things well. They're not designed to do other things, and the trick is trying to work out what goes where. So the trick is trying to save yourself some time. So when we built this USB gun for the Quake game, the trick with this one was, well, I didn't really want to build anything. So I didn't want to make a microcontroller, I didn't want to mess around carving up stuff. So what you do is you grab yourself an old USB mouse that someone's thrown away because the wheel's broken or something like that. You rip all the casing off. Then what you do is you cut all the buttons off where the mouse buttons are that you click, and you solder in switches into them. So each of these switches on the gun here has wires coming off of it that are routed onto the little board for the mouse. You then chop off anything that's not needed, like the wheels and rubbish, and you then bury the whole lot into the gun here. So inside the gun is an old USB mouse. Then you stick it in the USB port, and it just works. And you've got three buttons that you don't have to do anything for. Someone else has done all the hard work providing the microcontroller on board. They've built the USB conversion, it plugs in, and you don't even have to modify your software to use it because Quake and friends all understand mouse tricks already. The only catch, though, is that you are using it as a mouse device, so if your app doesn't talk mouse protocol or the mouse is being used for something else, then you're in trouble. But if you don't care about your mouse, this is one possible way to do it. So, you know, right now I can plug this in and I can change to the next slide using my gun. So, I mean, that's the neat part about it, is you can do these kind of things. And, you know, I built this gun in, like, you know, 2 hours. I went to the shop, bought the toy gun for, like, $2 from the cheap shop. The mouse was laying around. If you really have to buy a mouse, you can buy the cheapest, dirtiest mice for, like, $5 or something like that. It's so cheap. So, you know, you don't have to go to the trouble of making these super-duper microcontrollers. You can actually use other people's gear. And that's the trick with all this, is that as part of being lazy is that, you know, you can save yourself a lot of time by just chopping apart other people's stuff. Because this, you know, they make mice by the million, so they can keep the cost down. Whereas if you're buying microcontrollers, it becomes a lot more expensive. So one other thing you can do is the USB mice under Linux are all separated. So there's a device called Dev Input Mice, which is all of the input mice aggregated together. However, each mouse can also be addressed separately. Dev input mouse 1, mouse 2, mouse 3, mouse 4. So if you have a mouse plus that plugged in, you can program X Windows to listen to mouse 0, and then your app to listen to mouse 1, and you can separate them. Windows won't let you do that, I don't think. So that's one cool thing about Linux, is you can separate out USB devices very easily. And so, Yeah, that's sort of, yeah, that's something else that we've built. So, yeah, these are the kind of things you can do with hardware. So, I mean, the trick is start with that hack first. If that doesn't do what you want, then go the hard way, because you really should try to avoid it where possible. So anything you can buy that does the job, just cut it up and do stuff. So what we'll do is whenever we want to build something, the first thing you do is go to Toys R Us and you walk around looking for a toy that might do something close to what you want. Like we wanted to build something that could swivel a camera around. So we went looking everywhere through the toy shop, trying to find something that might do it. You get these toys that have little cranes and bulldozers and stuff like that. You buy the toy, chop it up, rip the electronics out. You can save yourself a pile of time than having to build it and machine it yourself. So that's probably the one thing you should take away from the tutorial is that, you know, you can do a lot of cool stuff with hardware as well. So, and a lot of it's quite easy. And I have a bit of electronics training, but you don't really need to know too much to make that gun control. So I'll just conclude my talk now. Got about 2 minutes to go, so I think we're right on time. And we've talked about a lot of material today. We had to gloss over heaps of it because there's a whole pile of stuff in the notes. So have a read through those if there's anything more you want to know about. If you're interested in it more, feel free to send me emails or whatever, ask questions. I'm happy to answer them. And we're also going to be putting code examples on the conference CD, so have a look out for that. And the examples are also on my website in case you want to look at them now. Yeah, so I mean, today we talked about video capture and display and some of their issues under Linux. And we talked about 3D vision tracking libraries using OpenGL and also building custom hardware. So these are some of the kinds of things that you can't really learn anywhere else. So I thought we'd do something a bit different to try to explain a few of the less commonly done things. Because I want to try to encourage people to think outside the box. I want to sort of people to say, hey, this 3D stuff's really cool. I want to start playing with this. Because, you know, you come to these conferences and you talk to people and people have really good ideas that other people have never thought about before because they're approaching it from different angles. So, you know, there's a possibility that some of the stuff we've talked about today could be useful for a future software project you might be working on. And, yeah, so we'll see what happens and hopefully I'll see you all next year with talks presenting some of the cool work you're doing or if you've done something interesting, we'd like to see it. So, good luck and don't fry your hardware. And these are my contact details. And thank you very much for letting me talk today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Mike.